Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 9th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows President Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy sitting at a round dinner table with white cloth. They've both got plates in front of them and holding their forks and knives in their hands upright. Biden's smiling. McCarthy has kind of an ambivalent look on his face. And on their plates are two parts of a loaf of bread. Biden's looks to be about two-thirds of the loaf, and McCarthy may have about a third of the loaf. They've each got small glasses of water. The headline is, Cutting a Deal. Did Biden and McCarthy each get half a loaf? That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Debt deal heading for passage. What happened? Hard-right Republicans rebelled this week over a deal House Speaker Kevin McCarthy struck with President Biden to end the debt limit standoff. But as the week went to press, the deal was poised to clear the House just in time to avert a catastrophic default. Not one Republican should vote for this bill, said Representative Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, one of many members of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus, angered by the agreement's relatively modest spending cuts. Trillions and trillions of dollars in debt for crumbs, said Caucus Chair Scott Perry, Republican from Pennsylvania. But despite their opposition, the bill passed the House Rules Committee, clearing a way for a House vote. And with large numbers of Democrats expected to join a majority of Republicans in backing the bill, opponents conceded they lacked the leverage to stop it. The deal is good news for the American people, said Biden. It takes the threat of catastrophic default off the table, protects our hard-earned and historic economic recovery. The bill suspends the debt ceiling for 2 years while keeping discretionary spending unrelated to defense or veterans programs flat next year and increasing it by only 1% in 2025. It raises from 49 to 54 the age limit for food stamp recipients subjected to work requirements, claws back $27 billion in unspent COVID relief funds, and reallocates $20 billion of the $80 billion in new IRS funding approved last year. The measure will cut spending by $55 billion in 2024 and $81 billion in 2025, according to a New York Times analysis. The actual impact on the annual deficit of roughly $1.5 trillion will be only a few tenths of a percentage point, said Deutsche Bank analyst. Biden preserved spending for clean energy tax credits, kept his student loan forgiveness plan alive, and avoided steep safety net cuts and new work requirements for Medicaid, while the two-year deal punched the next debt limit negotiation until after the 2024 election. Some angry Republicans broached the idea of removing McCarthy as Speaker, but there wasn't much support for that move. Hard-right Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene called the deal a shit sandwich, but said removing McCarthy would be a horrible decision. What the editorial said. Finally, said the Washington Post, it's hard to view this as a celebratory moment, given how close we came to a catastrophic default. But it's a relief to see the economy pull back from the cliff's edge and learn that amid D.C.'s rancor, bipartisanship is still possible. If any sort of political center still exists in Washington, this sensible deal is about as close as it comes to finding it. Divided government is rarely pretty, but sometimes it can yield good results, said the Wall Street Journal. By sticking together, Republicans scored a significant victory for GOP priorities, modestly paring back social welfare spending while sparing defense from similar cuts. The GOP did not get the 10 years of enforceable spending limits they sought and had to settle for two. But power sharing requires compromise. What the columnist said. After all the Republicans' apocalyptic rhetoric, the big surprise is that they settled for such a modest package of spending nips and safety net tucks, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times. The deal leaves Biden's major achievements, from the Inflation Reduction Act to student loan cancellation, intact. Threatening national default to get crumbs is like threatening to detonate a bomb beneath the bank unless the teller gives you $150 and a commemorative mug. The hardliners' rage at McCarthy is mystifying, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. What did they expect? Did they think Biden, who initially refused to negotiate at all, would swallow everything they demanded and the Democratic-controlled Senate would choke it down? With only one chamber in GOP control, some minor concessions were the best McCarthy could hope for. And this shrewd deal delivers. Biden just proved his critics wrong. Again, said Michael A. Cohen in MSNBC.com. During the 2020 campaign, Beltway pundits mocked his claim that he could work with Republicans. Yet here we are, with yet another bipartisan deal that's a clear win for the White House. It follows similar wins, such as a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, the most sweeping gun control measure in decades, and laws to expand veterans' benefits and protect same-sex marriage. With apologies to Peggy Lee, is that all there is? Said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. This deal looks pretty similar to what routine budget negotiations would have produced in the fall, but it came at a steep cost. The U.S. has spent months beclowning itself before the rest of the world while China and Russia mocked our dysfunction. Though we dodged a bullet this time, we may have set ourselves up for another hostage crisis 2 years hence. Controversy of the week. Trump. Could democracy survive a second term? Was this the week the Republican establishment's grand plan to deny Donald Trump the nomination fell apart, asked Jonathan Martin in Politico. After Ron DeSantis' muffed launch dealt another blow to his struggling campaign, there is suddenly no obvious rival for anti-Trump Republicans to rally around. In fact, with Senator Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, Mike Pence, and many other Republican candidates jumping into the race, 2024 is starting to look like a replay of 2016, when opposition to Trump was diluted among a total of 17 candidates. That let Trump win the nomination with just 45% of the primary vote. It could happen again. If Trump does win the GOP nomination, said Josh Dawsey in the Washington Post, he will run on an even more radically extreme platform than the last two times. The January 6th Capitol riot that he once claimed to be horrified by, he now calls a beautiful day, and he's pledged to pardon a large portion of the rioters if elected. He continues to insist elections are rigged and has vowed to inflict retribution on Democrats, liberal elites, and the disloyal Republicans he blames for thwarting his authoritarian ambitions during his first term. The adults in the room, like former Pentagon Chief Jim Mattis and Chief of Staff John Kelly, would be replaced by loyal stooges in a second Trump administration, which would be vastly more dangerous and chaotic than the first. How is this even happening, said Bloomberg in an editorial. By any sane calculation, Trump is the last person Republicans should want to nominate. he's become electoral poison. The first president since the Great Depression to lose the House, Senate, and the White House after a single term. In coming months, he faces numerous prosecutions, including felony charges for his attempts to overturn the 2020 election. With 70% of Americans, including 44% of Republicans, saying they don't want Trump to run again, why would the GOP bring back the chaos, corruption, and manifest incompetence of the Trump show? Sadly, many Republican primary voters like MAGA politics, said Clarence Luzon in The Nation. The GOP base now openly embraces the white Christian nationalism, abortion extremism, vigilante violence, and angry populism that Trump championed. The looming threat to America isn't just Trump, but a Republican Party on a far-right trek toward authoritarianism. For the true believers, there's no turning back, said Peter Wenner in The Atlantic. Some acknowledge that Trump is a bull in a china shop, but see him as the fiercest fighter for their tribe in a culture war that they feel they are losing. Without him or someone like him in the White House, MAGA voters are convinced their America is doomed. Trump also faces a personal existential threat, said David Rothkopf in The Daily Beast. Winning the White House may be his best chance for escaping a prison term. For his pal, Russian President Vladimir Putin, a Trump victory might be the only way to salvage his epic blunder of the war in Ukraine, which a re-elected Trump would promptly end by cutting off arms to Kyiv. In 2024, an unholy alliance of MAGA World and the Kremlin has every incentive to try to steal or overturn the election. A second Trump term would be a disaster for the U.S. and the world. But two repulsive and dangerous men very badly need it to happen. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for hole digging. After the state of Colorado, exasperated with hikers defecating on the state's scenic trails, began giving away free waste burial kits. The kits, a trowel, and a biodegradable wipe tablets are part of the state's Do Colorado Right campaign. It was a good week for normalcy, with news that the TSA screened 2.74 million air travelers on the Friday before Memorial Day, making it the busiest day of air travel since the epic disruption of the pandemic. And it was a good week for oceanfront property, with an announcement from the General Services Administration that it is giving away 10 free lighthouses, which in the GPS era are no longer needed to keep ships from running aground. The structures, a GSA spokesman noted, are often located in prominent locations that offer breathtaking views. But it was a bad week for going overboard, with the news that the cost of the average U.S. wedding has ballooned to $29,000, fueled partly by such photogenic extravagances as champagne towers and donut walls. It was a bad week for Find My Phone, after Rajesh Vishwas, 32, an Indian government official, was fired for having a reservoir drained so he could retrieve the smartphone he dropped. Officials say the 528,000 gallons of water wasted could have irrigated 1,482 acres of farmland. And it was a bad week for impatience, after a passenger aboard an Asiana Airlines flight descending to land at South Korea's Daegu Airport opened the emergency exit door while the plane was still 650 feet above the runway. The unnamed man explained to police that the flight was taking longer than it should have. A short and other news piece. Oath Keepers leader gets 18-year sentence. Stuart Rhodes, leader of the far-right Oath Keepers, was sentenced last week to 18 years in prison, the longest sentence yet for a January 6 insurrectionist. Rhodes, 58, claimed to be a political prisoner, but Judge Amit Mehta told Rhodes he was the ringleader of the violent riot and presents an ongoing threat and a peril to this country. Kelly Meggs, who led Oath Keepers storming the Capitol, was sentenced to 12 years in prison. Seven other Oath Keepers have been convicted or pleaded guilty to seditious conspiracy, as have four members of the far-right Proud Boys. The Oath Keepers stockpiled weapons in Virginia, and Rhodes called on them to fight a bloody civil war to keep President Trump in power. This week's briefing, How Trump's Wall is Working. Republicans have proposed restarting construction on ex-President Trump's unfinished wall. Is the wall effective? How much wall did Trump build? At a recent CNN town hall, former President Donald Trump claimed that his administration finished building a wall along the 1,954-mile border separating the U.S. and Mexico. But according to a Customs and Border Protection report written 2 days after Trump left office in 2021, about 458 miles of the wall were completed under his administration, with another 280 miles identified for construction but never finished. Of those 458 miles, just 52 covered sections of the border that hadn't previously had a barrier. The other 406 replaced shorter barriers that already existed with a fence made of reinforced hollow steel bollards ranging from 18 to 33 feet high. In some sections, lights, cameras, and sensors accompanied the new barriers. In others, a secondary fence was built to reinforce an existing one. The project cost an estimated $15 billion, with the money coming from Department of Defense funds and appropriations from Congress. Combined with fencing that pre-existed Trump's presidency, about 700 miles, mostly along public land in Arizona and New Mexico, now have a barrier. In May, House Republicans passed an immigration bill calling for resuming construction. Is the new wall effective? It does not seem to be deterring migrants from coming to or crossing the border. The number of crossings, as measured by apprehensions at the border, rose steeply during Trump's term, more than doubling from 2018 to 2019. The pandemic initially slowed migration, but by spring 2021, the number of unlawful border crossings and arrests, separate from those legally applying for asylum, had risen above the totals recorded in most months before Trump began building the wall. Border Patrol officials maintain, however, that the towering bollards have served a purpose. There's a psychological reason, said Chief Patrol Agent Patricia McGurk-Daniel. It's a high fence. You don't want to cross it. But it's also tall enough our agents can see through. Professional smugglers and determined migrants, however, have found myriad ways to get through and over the wall. How do they do that? Saws and other inexpensive power tools were used to cut holes in the wall more than 3,200 times between 2019 and 2021, costing the government $2.6 million in repairs. From October 2021 to September 2022, it was breached 4,101 times, an average of about 11 breaches per day. Some smugglers have essentially created doors in the wall by disguising the holes they created in the bollards with tinted putty that they remove every time they want to help people cross. Smugglers have also dug tunnels or climbed over the barrier on ladders or crossed at one of the wall's many gaps. Contractors working on the wall built new roads to reach remote border areas. Those paths now guide migrants to make it across. There are so many access roads that it's impossible for someone to walk right up to the places where the wall ends and have someone just pick them up, said conservationist Baylor Clark, who is trying to preserve land along the border. Is there a human cost? The wall has made crossing the border more dangerous. Migrants circumventing the wall have drowned swimming across the Rio Grande and collapsed from heat exposure in the desert. Some of those climbing over it with ladders or by hand have fallen as much as 30 feet, suffering severe injuries, some fatal. From 2019 to 2021, the University of California at San Diego Medical Center recorded 375 patients admitted due to falls. In fiscal year 2022, at least 853 migrants died crossing the border, breaking the previous year's record of 546. Border Patrol also recorded about 22,000 rescues of distressed migrants in that time, up 72% from the previous year. The United Nations-affiliated International Organization for Migration calls the U.S.-Mexico border the deadliest land crossing in the world. What's changed under Biden? As the clock ran out on Trump's presidency in 2020, construction crews tried in vain to finish the job. Instead, tens of thousands of heavy steel bollards worth $350 million were left unused, rusting in the Southwest sun. President Biden, who campaigned on a promise not to build another foot of wall, allowed some construction to continue to honor existing contracts and filled some gaps in Arizona, Texas, and California. Some of the construction was going to have to be finished, or else it would create a legal risk, said former White House senior official. Why the talk of building more? Last month, Biden ended Title 42, the Trump-era immigration policy that allowed authorities to turn back migrants without granting them the right to seek asylum. But it was replaced with a tougher asylum policy, and the predicted surge of migrants didn't materialize. Many migrants are choosing to wait in Mexico or get an official asylum appointment, to cross at a checkpoint, or to cross with the intent of seeking asylum once detained. Still, conservatives remain committed to the wall as a statement about the border, said Andrew Steele of the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. This was always about a larger symbolism about walling off America from outside dangers, he said. Time now for a few of the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S. Kissinger's blood-stained legacy. As Henry Kissinger turns 100 this week, tributes from his admirers are omitting his bloody legacy, said Fred Kaplan. As Secretary of State and then National Security Advisor under Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, Kissinger achieved some moments of triumph, notably U.S.-Soviet detente and the opening of China. But his chessboard tradecraft wreaked havoc all over the globe and damaged America's own reputation. He was chief architect of U.S. efforts to support Augusto Pinochet's 1973 right-wing military coup in Chile, then turned a blind eye to Pinochet's murderous repression of socialist supporters of the ousted president, Salvador Allende. Kissinger supported an even more brutal and murderous military coup in Argentina 3 years later. In 1975, he gave a U.S. green light to Indonesia's invasion of East Timor, which left at least 100,000 civilians dead. His worst offense may have been the U.S.'s secret bombings of Cambodia, which killed 150,000 and so destabilized the country that the murderous Khmer Rouge took over. Kissinger claimed his realpolitik required pragmatic choices between lesser evils, but his version was utterly amoral, creating a dreadful image of America in the world that seriously damaged U.S. interests. Why new COVID shots are coming. This fall, millions of Americans might be lining up for yet another kind of COVID vaccine, one specifically tailored to the latest dominant variant, said Catherine J. Wu. A World Health Organization advisory group and other researchers are endorsing a vaccine with only the spike protein for the currently circulating XBB.1 lineage of the Omicron variant. Last year, going all in on Omicron seemed too risky in case the coronavirus evolved in a new direction. So experts chose instead to design a bivalent vaccine for both the original COVID strain and the BA5 Omicron subvariant, neither of which is meaningfully around anymore. Now they think devoting half the vaccine to the original virus will produce a more lackluster antibody response than is optimal. So the monovalent shot tailored to XBB1 is in the works. Abundant data show that vaccines are essential for preventing severe disease and death, especially among older adults and other vulnerable people, and that some cadence of boosting is probably necessary to keep the shot's effectiveness high. Until a pan-coronavirus vaccine against all variants is developed, we'll have to keep scrambling to play catch-up. This column comes from China. College grads see no jobs, no future. President Xi Jinping wants to send China's brightest young minds out into the countryside, said Katrin Buchenbacher. With a jobless rate for 16 to 20-year-olds at 20%, a staggering number of college graduates can't find work. That's partly because so many businesses that usually hire entry-level professionals went under during China's harsh COVID lockdowns. But it's also because these strict new regulations on sectors like education and entertainment resulted in the elimination of millions of white-collar jobs. A record 12 million more people are due to graduate from college this June, but the knowledge economy jobs they hope for just don't exist. Meanwhile, the manufacturing sector is bemoaning a serious shortage of skilled labor. So Xi is now copying Mao Zedong, who famously ordered the elite into the fields. The youth must take responsibility and prepare for hard times, Xi warned in his Youth Day address in May. They must look for work in the provinces. Provincial governments are thrilled. Guangdong has already pledged to find work in the villages for 300,000 grads. But the strategy could prove socially explosive. The urban youth have become accustomed to personal freedom. They won't take kindly to being banished from the cities. On to the last word, our in-depth article. Prolonging the suffering. For patients dying, subjected to treatments they can't refuse, futile medical interventions are not heroic, said ICU nurse Kristen McConnell in The Atlantic. They turn helpless people into prisoners. Early in my career as an ICU nurse, a chatty resident and I were working together at the bedside of a profoundly ill patient. The resident asked me how I liked my job. Looking at the young man in front of us, I told him that I'd been surprised to learn how much we did for patients we knew were not going to get better. A fungal infection had caused large abscesses in this patient's brain. Surgery hadn't healed him, and numerous signs, his unstable vitals, his extremely poor neuro exam, indicated that if it was unlikely he would survive, it was obvious he would never wake up. His swelling brain was putting pressure on his optic nerve, causing his pupils to dilate and raising the threat of herniation, in which the brain is squeezed through the hole at the bottom of the skull. Days ago, he had been impossible to sedate. Now he required no sedation, passively receiving breaths from the ventilator. "Oh, yeah," the resident said with a shrug. "It's crazy." Americans openly discuss many problems in healthcare, such as out-of-control cost, greedy insurance companies, and understaffing, but not so much futile care, which is generally defined as an intervention that does not benefit the patient. It is a subjective term, but concerns about medically futile treatment at end of life have risen over the past decade. According to a 2022 review in BMC Palliative Care, in one study, critical care specialists at five ICUs reported that 11% of patients received futile treatment, and another 8.6% received treatment that was probably futile. My 10 years as an ICU nurse have shown me that futile care occurs everywhere, and that it is confusing and traumatic for family members, demoralizing for doctors and nurses, and dehumanizing for patients. My experience has also shown me that most Americans are not prepared for what can happen in an ICU. As healthcare professionals, we need to pull back the curtain. As a society, we need to encourage people to have difficult conversations and make difficult decisions about what forms of care are acceptable to them long before the moment of crisis. At a party some years ago, two residents and I stood apart from the cheerful crowd, trading horror stories about coding patients, performing CPR with drugs and intubation, coding a patient multiple times. "She probably didn't have an intact rib left," my friend said. "Coding a 93-year-old for more than an hour." We weren't shocking one another. We were venting with gallows humor, which sometimes feels like the only thing healthcare underlings can do when medicine extends human tragedies beyond their natural limits. I commented that we shouldn't code people who are so far gone that we don't even stop to wonder how they would feel about it. Of course, I knew how naive this sounded. If the patient doesn't have an order limiting care, we do everything. Full code. That's just the way it is. One resident replied with a grin, "I hate hospitals." Conversations among nurses about getting do not resuscitate and do not intubate orders are commonplace. Some jokingly describe the DNR-DNI face tattoo they'll get for fear their advanced directive won't be found at the crucial moment. I remember an older nurse shaking her head about a patient receiving a central line, a larger and longer-lasting IV placed in a large vein and threaded close to the heart, and saying, "When it's my turn to get a triple lumen femoral line, just don't bother." The shrugging, the eye rolling, the intentions to personally avoid such a sorry fate. Notice the passivity with which we accept the reality of providing care that we know doesn't help. Hopeless codes are one thing. But what disturbs me more, and happens more often, is providing intensive care to people who have lost the ability to communicate or move, who will not recover but are prevented from dying. Because of powerful drugs that boost blood pressure and normalize cardiac function, and machines that perform the work of vital organs, preventing someone from dying immediately is far easier than returning them to health. because people can live long-term on ventilators, receiving medication and nutrition through feeding tubes, many patients can be stabilized, survive, and leave intensive care only to live on in limbo, able to do literally nothing but lie in bed, many of them permanently unconscious, sometimes with eyes open but completely unable to communicate or move. Meanwhile, medical professionals clean them, suction their oral and tracheal secretions, turn them, draw their blood, and treat every irregularity in their blood work or vital signs. In this context, the inabilities to breathe, move, eat, and communicate are not problems that must be solved. Rather, they become baseline conditions that factor into the discharge plan. Some people would consider rescuing a patient who then lives in a state of profound disability and dependence to be beneficial. Others would not. To me, providing physically invasive medical care to keep people alive when they are past the point of returning to any sort of waking life feels morally compromising, not to mention cruel. But what I think and feel doesn't matter. What matters is what the patient would think, and whether the people who make choices about the patient's care both know what the patient would think and understand the likelihood that their choices will have this result. This is often not the case. In American hospitals, the standard is to keep patients alive by all means possible, unless they or their surrogate decision makers actively choose to limit interventions. Ideally, the surrogate understands the patient's prognosis as well as their expected quality of life. But the situation is often not ideal. Hospital staff are always busy. Families may be unavailable. Both doctors and family members may feel uncomfortable discussing these sensitive issues. Most people have not had clear conversations with their families about the types of medical interventions or life support they would like to receive. About two-thirds of Americans have not completed any advanced health care directive, and only 32% have discussed their wishes for end-of-life care with their family. Although it's nice to think that people who are close to death can discuss their wishes with their loved ones, all healthcare workers know that you can be well one day and on life support the next, at any age. Critical care is unfamiliar and complicated. Family members' emotional stress in these circumstances makes processing information difficult. Predicting the future for critically ill patients is not a simple matter. And many patients who require intensive care have long and uncertain roads to recovery and may need to adjust to a very different life. I'm not talking about these patients, but about those who will do nothing for the rest of their life but passively receive care. These are the patients who haunt me, because I can't believe that people would choose to live that life, and I know that, much of the time, they haven't chosen it. I will never forget a patient who had been cared for at home, bedbound, nonverbal, fed through a tube, and immobile by health aides after multiple strokes. He had no family or personal contacts in his medical record. He had slipped into dementia without any advanced care planning and was now brought to the ER actively dying after another stroke. His breathing inadequate and his heart rhythm unstable. He was intubated, medicated, and admitted to the ICU. His limbs were stiff and swollen, and because he could not possibly pull out his breathing tube, he was on minimal sedation. Neither the social worker who coordinated his home care nor his general physician was willing to discuss moving him to comfort care. They said they just kept up his appointments and medications, as if he would live forever. So while the social work and legal departments began the slow process of obtaining a court-appointed healthcare proxy, I've never heard of a court-appointed proxy doing anything other than maintaining the status quo, or of one even visiting the patient in the hospital, we provided intensive care, waiting for him to stabilize enough to get a tracheostomy so that he could go to a nursing home on a ventilator. He no longer had a choice. Unlike most patients in this condition, the poor man was awake, and his eyes were on me. I tried to soothe him with my voice, my hands, and eye contact, and I lied, saying that it was okay, that we were helping him. Medically sustained limbo between life and death does not happen only to people whose primary illness or injury is neurological. Brain damage from lack of oxygen can be caused by cardiac arrest, for instance. I worked a shift in the understaffed medical ICU last year and was nervous that the patients would be unfamiliar and challenging. I've always worked on a neuro unit, but a nurse said, "Your assignment is easy. Just two vegetables and a walkie-talkie." These two vegetables were now medically stable, on ventilators with tracheostomies, fed and medicated through tubes implanted in their stomachs, and awaiting placement in long-term care. Such unfortunate outcomes are not the natural or inevitable consequences of the injuries or illnesses the patient suffered. They are the consequences of using intensive interventions to medically stabilize the patients despite their devastating injuries. Certainly, people have the right to live this way and to be cared for. But because these patients live like prisoners, with no self-determination and no free will, and without even the ability to comment on their circumstances, the bar should be high for treating them this way. We should know they want this, otherwise it is extraordinarily inhumane. But the bar is low. They may not even have known it was possible to end up this way. Perhaps the eeriest thing about these patients is in limbo is that their very voicelessness makes them invisible. Nurses and doctors become accustomed to offering medical assistance that doesn't help people, normalizing the situation, which makes it all the more difficult for family members to resist the momentum of these interventions. We become jaded, burying the anguish and confusion of providing health care that feels more like torture until it feels routine. At the core of this problem is that healthcare workers have very different perspectives from families and may fail to communicate them, resulting in confusion about the patient's situation. A recent study of surrogate decision makers in the neuroscience unit where I work found that nearly all surrogates rated their understanding of the patient's medical condition as excellent or good, but they were largely unable to correctly identify the patient's reason for admission, pinpoint the organ systems being treated, or name all of the assessments and interventions performed. Similarly, a study conducted in a trauma ICU found that even though families reported having high-quality communication with the surgical team, many of them misunderstood the surgeon's take on the patient's prognosis. Consider this blunt demonstration of the chasm between medical and lay points of view. In a large survey conducted at Rush University Medical Center and the University of Chicago Medical Center, researchers found that almost 70% of the medical ICU and cardiac ICU doctors, nurses, and nurse practitioners reported that a patient they had cared for had received a slow code, defined as a practice where physicians and nurses pretend to conduct advanced cardiac life support but do not provide full resuscitation efforts with energy or enthusiasm because of the belief that the code is medically futile. The most common reason given for conducting a slow code was that it served as a middle ground between what providers and families thought was best for the patient. These data are not reassuring, but acknowledging the dysfunction is the first step toward fixing it. Public health campaigns tend to focus on what people should do to stay healthy. Get vaccinated, get a mammogram, get tested, but they've neglected to teach people what it means to be sick. There is ample opportunity for improvement here. Indeed, if one good thing came out of the pandemic, it is that people are more aware of what intensive care is, what ventilators do, and what being intubated means. But we need to go further and actively educate people about our bodies and how they work, and about how they fail. This article was originally published by The Atlantic. Read one of the obituaries this week. The explosive singer of soul and grit, Tina Turner, 1939-2023. Tina Turner was a living phoenix, a symbol of resilience and raw female power. A riveting stage presence, she honed her skill alongside husband Ike Turner, fronting a revue that in the 1960s and early 70s racked up a string of R&B hits and a reputation for frenetic live shows. But Ike was a violent, domineering husband who abused her physically and emotionally, and one night in 1976, she walked out on him, leaving a Dallas hotel with just 36 cents in her pocket. Lean years followed, but so did a remarkable second act that began with the album Private Dancer. The 1984 smash won four Grammys, including for number one hit, What's Love Got to Do with It, and remade Turner as one of pop's top arena acts. Each electrifying swing of her miniskirt, every slide of her three-inch Manolos across the stage sends a message, said fan Oprah Winfrey. I will not be broken. Turner was born Anna Mae Bullock in Nutbush, Tennessee, where her parents were sharecroppers, said Variety. After they split, she shuttled among relatives in St. Louis, where she finished high school and began going to black nightclubs. With no musical experience outside church, she sang one night with Ike Turner's band in 1958, and won a backup singer spot while still a teenager. Soon he rebuilt his act around Tina, said The Guardian, and the Ike and Tina Turner Revue took the R&B circuit by storm. But over their 16-year marriage, Ike routinely beat Tina in cocaine-fueled bursts of violence. After she left, she struggled to build a solo career, appearing in ill-conceived cabaret acts, said The New York Times. With help from fan David Bowie, she signed with Capitol Records in 1983 and made Private Dancer. Pairing her raw, urgent vocals with a smooth, synthesized sound, it spawned three hits to become an enduring classic. Turner toured steadily for the next two decades. She said she drew strength from both her Buddhist faith and her newfound happiness living in Switzerland with her second husband, Erwin Bach, a German music producer who donated a kidney to her in 2017. At 80, I can say with a smile that I have truly won in every aspect of my life, she said in 2020. I never felt low for very long. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. Clean Water Act. Supreme Court rewrites a law. The Supreme Court just gutted the Clean Water Act, and the effect will likely be devastating, said Richard J. Lazarus in the Washington Post. Last week, an activist Supreme Court voted 5-4 to roll back the 1972 Clean Water Act in Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency, severely curtailing the EPA's authority to block development and discharges of pollution into marshes and bogs that empty into rivers, lakes, and oceans. The Clean Water Act authorizes the agency to regulate navigable waters, which Congress expressly defined to include wetlands adjacent to larger bodies of water. But the Supreme Court's conservatives threw out 50 years of precedent, ruling that wetlands can be protected only if they have a continuous surface connection to larger bodies of water. So radical was this ruling that Justice Brett Kavanaugh sided with the three liberal justices and criticized his colleagues for ignoring the text of the law and showing a blatant disregard for pollution and public health. Actually, this ruling signals a welcome trend from the court's conservative majority, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. The Clean Water Act's definitions of navigable waters and adjacent were overly broad and unclear. Ambiguity that administrative agencies exploit in order to extend regulatory reach. The EPA has gradually stretched the definition of waters it regulates so far that it could mean the Mississippi River or a puddle in your backyard, enabling bureaucrats and environmental activists to stop people from building on their property. This was a landmark decision pruning back an overgrown administrative state, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The majority simply stopped a regulatory land grab. It's the conservative justices who are engaging in an abuse of power, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. This court apparently believes it has a sacred duty to rewrite any law it doesn't like. The text and clear intent of the Clean Water Act did not meet with the approval of Justice Samuel Alito and his brethren, so they simply substituted their own language and policy preferences. That was so indefensible that even Kavanaugh tartly reminded his colleagues of their supposed commitment to textualism. Sadly, this court just removed about half of the country's wetlands from protection, giving landowners maximum latitude to fill in, build upon, or otherwise obliterate some of the most valuable ecosystems on Earth. Target, a backlash over gay pride displays. Companies have been embracing Gay Pride Month for years, said Emily Stewart in Vox. But this June, businesses that pay tribute to the LGBTQ community should brace for a backlash. With anti-trans sentiment and conservative anger over woke marketing at a boiling point, Target has become the latest corporation to find itself caught up in the culture wars. The retailer's pride displays, rainbow-striped shirts, clothes reading "Not a Phrase, Not a Phase," and "Super Queer," children's books about transgender issues and gender fluidity, infuriated some customers who screamed at and threatened employees and attacked displays of pride-themed merchandise. In response, Target moved pride displays to the backs of some stores and removed some of the products for sale. Corporate America's embrace of rainbow capitalism isn't going away, but boycotts may make some companies a little queasy. Target claimed it moved pride displays because of threats, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner, as if only hateful, violent bigots would oppose pride displays. But normal people nationwide are fed up with corporate pandering to left-wing activism and the trans movement, which explains why the Target boycott caused the company to lose more than $9 billion in market value. After Bud Light chose to feature trans social media personality Dylan Mulvaney in an online marketing campaign, sales dropped by nearly 25%, and the beer's parent company, Anheuser-Busch, saw its market value plummet $19 billion. Corporations may want to seem inclusive and edgy to win over urban progressives, said Jonathan Turley in The Hill, but too much agenda-driven proselytizing and virtue signaling is a big turnoff to a lot of Americans. Corporations have only one real agenda, to make money, said Greg Sargent in The Washington Post. They're making self-interested decisions in response to consumer preferences and social change, as they always have. Many corporations reluctantly backed the civil rights movement in the 1960s and the gay rights movement in the subsequent decades for the same reason they back Pride Month or Black Lives Matter today, to reach new customers and to show existing customers they have a moral conscience. These are profit-oriented decisions. The boycotts of Target and Bud Light may inflict pain in the short term, but over time, no amount of bullying and threats can stop society from changing and evolving. And we have time for a few of the short notes. Republican legislators have proposed loosening child labor laws in at least 10 states over the past 2 years. Laws have been proposed to allow 14-year-olds to work mining, logging, and meatpacking jobs, to work until 9 p.m. on school nights, and to serve alcohol in bars and restaurants. A retired firefighter from Arkansas who was photographed with his feet on the desk of then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office during the January 6th Capitol attack was sentenced last week to 4.5 years in prison. Richard Big O Barnett carried a stun gun into the Capitol, stole a piece of Pelosi's mail, and left her a note calling her a bitch. At least 19 states have started to remove residents from Medicaid rolls since the pandemic-era ban on cutting off coverage expired in March. The federal government estimates states will shed 15 million from their Medicaid rolls, including 7 million who remain eligible, and millions of children. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from G.K. Chesterton, quoted in Christian Headlines. He says, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.